Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and discuss the reading of a redacted version of the Constitution on the floor of the House today. And unlike the Republican congressman, unlike the Republican congressman who organized the reading, we will speak with a constitutional scholar who actually knows the Constitution, Dahlia Lithwick. We'll also discuss the forthcoming tutorial on the Constitution to be given by the new Congress, given to the new Congress by Supreme Court Justice Scalia at the invitation of the leader of the Tea Party caucus, Michelle Bachmann. Then we'll look into whether the ruling elite in Iran is becoming unglued. We already know that many are unhinged, but recent reports from WikiLeaks tell of the head of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, the real power behind the throne, slapping President Ahmadinejad in the face. Dan Brunberg, a professor at Georgetown University who specializes in Iran, joins us to analyze the recent firing of Iran's foreign minister, the capture of a vulture the regime claims works for Mossad, and the arrest of an American woman accused of spying for America with a bugging device in her tooth. Then finally, we'll discuss the state of the state of California, now under new management, with the former deputy treasurer of the state of California, Mark Paul. We will assess whether there is a chance of restoring fiscal sanity, overturning Proposition 13, and surviving a hostile Congress in Washington that appears to want to force California into bankruptcy and break the public employee unions. I'm speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who is a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor at Slate, where she specializes in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's already a storm of controversy surrounding Justice Scalia from his recent remarks that the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause doesn't extend to women. But let's begin discussing his upcoming trip to Capitol Hill at the invitation of one of the Tea Party leaders in the House, Representative Michelle Bachmann. Does that strike you as a little bit crossing the line? I mean, we always talk about the separation of powers. I'm beginning to wonder how separate these powers are between the conservatives on the Supreme Court and the Republican Party.
Well, you'll be charmed to hear that the topic of Justice Scalia's upcoming speech to the Tea Party folks is, in fact, quote, the separation of powers. So if irony makes your head explode, then that's his topic. It's a very interesting problem. I don't think that there's anything necessarily wrong with Supreme Court justices being asked to, I guess in this case it's being framed as he's teaching a class on the Constitution, and Michelle Bachmann has gone out of her way to say that even though the Tea Party has organized this, it's certainly open to anyone who wants to come and attend and learn.
So you mean all those representatives she calls socialists and communists?
Exactly.
So
she's certainly going out of her way to say that this is open to anyone, and the Supreme Court is going out of its way to say, you know, justices should be allowed to go speak to anyone. You know, they can go to law schools and they can go speak at the Federalist Society, so why shouldn't they go speak to the Congress? You know, it does become, as a matter of sort of political symbolism, very fraught because we're looking at a House of Representatives that, you know, is reading the Constitution from the House floor, kind of purporting to suddenly have discovered the Constitution after, you know, decades of neglect, and they are for the first time really going to drill down and understand the Constitution. Michelle Bachmann sort of likens it to being in training. You know, they're going to go to this coach and he's going to teach them how it's done. And all that is very problematic because I think it lends credence to the idea, first and foremost, that prior legislators were not adhering to the Constitution, and that certainly, I think, the Tea Party message, you know, the message is that the Congress has overreached massively and vastly, you know, expanded its powers beyond the Constitution. And so for the first time, if they read it, maybe they can check themselves. And so this is of a piece with this sentiment that we're going to get square on the Constitution. And then it becomes problematic because there's a real question about whether just one justice in his view of the Constitution is all that they should be learning.
Well, we'll hold our breath, Dahlia Lithwick, to see who shows up, whether the un-American congressmen show up on January the 24th. But, of course, the reading today of the Constitution, they alternated. At one point, actually, it was a Democrat reading the 14th Amendment, and when a teabagger protested and had to be ejected on the basis that when he read the piece about people born in the only people born in the United States can become president of the United States. So yeah. That was today's hijinks.
You know, today was, I thought, very, very problematic for other reasons. One, you know, it is true. It was certainly bipartisan reading the Constitution. But I thought what was most interesting today, Ian, was that they read what they called a redacted or amended Constitution. In other words, the same Tea Party that has purported to be wanting to, you know, restore fealty and respect for the Constitution got up and read part of it today. And, you know, the comments that were made, I mean, this was raised as a question on the House floor even before they began to read the Constitution. And Virginia Republican Bob Goodlatte, who is sort of shepherding this whole enterprise, said, oh, you know, I checked with the Congressional Research Service and the Library of Congress, and they say that there's this redacted copy of the Constitution. There is this amended Constitution, and that's what they're going to read. And then they went on to, you know, leave out all the three-fifths stuff about, you know, African-Americans being three-fifths of a person, and they left out the 18th Amendment. So they picked and chose, and there's no official redacted version of the Constitution. There's a Constitution, and the three-fifths language is still there. It was never erased, and I think it's extremely fraught proposition for the Tea Party folks to say, we want to restore the Constitution and then read only bits of it that you like.
And Representative Goodlatte was recently on Lawrence O'Donnell's program on MSNBC, where he exhibited a very, very hazy understanding of the very Constitution that he is leading the reading of. Two congressmen, of course, one of whom, Sessions from New York, went to the floor to introduce the bill to overturn and repeal the health care laws. He turned out he hadn't been properly sworn in because he was at a fundraiser. So already, I mean, I shouldn't laugh, but already there's some major, major kind of questions about, I don't know about the priorities of some of these people, but the education of some of these people about if you don't know the Constitution, you don't know the House rules. You know?
That's right, and I think it's really, again, you know, as a matter of symbolism, to drape yourself in the Constitution, to say everything that is wrong with America is a function of our drifting away from the Constitution, and then as one of your first legislative acts to try to gut the 14th Amendment, you know, you sort of, I remember, you know, a con law teacher once teaching me, you can't sort of suck and blow. It is what it is. And if you're for the Constitution, you're for all of it. And if you want to amend it, go ahead and amend it. But I don't think what you get to do is, you know, read selectively or revere it to the point of near, I think, biblical reverence, and then at the same time say, you know, we're going to go through with our red pen and gut everything that doesn't jibe with our policy program. And I think that's really the danger of this current constitutional fervor, is that it's not constitutional fervor. It's fervor for some of the Constitution, and I think that's just disingenuous in the extreme.
And it can't be dismissed as the Reader's Digest version of the Constitution. It seems like a very selective one. So, again, I'm speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the Supreme Court and judicial issues for Newsweek and Slate. Now, being an originalist, as Justice Scalia is often described, and I imagine he feels that way, I just don't get it. By the way, there's an op-ed in today's LA Times talking about Scalia's right to speak. I don't know that anybody ever questioned his right to speak. It's just a question, I think, about the separation of powers here. But let's just touch on this, on what seems to be extraordinary to me, Dahlia, and that is that, am I right in suggesting that he has said recently in California, Scalia, that the Equal Protection Clause, which I believe was intentionally broad because its purpose was to ensure a fairer society. He saying that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment doesn't necessarily apply to women, and that's half of our population. At the same time, I believe he and others, fellow conservatives on the court, believe that the 14th Amendment applies to corporations, and of course that law was what the Supreme Court ruling was passed in the 19th century. So am I right in wondering what kind of priorities they are, where you don't extend rights to women, but you do to corporations?
Well, I think one thing that I find really interesting about this current kerfuffle about Scalia and the 14th Amendment is that he said exactly the same thing in a talk in September. So he's at least consistent in his very narrow reading of the Constitution. I mean, what he says is that, you know, the Reconstruction Amendments were passed to protect African Americans, not women, not homosexuals. And if you, America, want to explicitly protect women and homosexuals, pass more amendments. And so he's reading it, you know, in vintage Scalia fashion, completely narrowly and as, you know, in a crabbed as fashion as he can. So this isn't new. This is how he likes to read laws. You're quite right that the Citizens United decision, you know, opted to give First Amendment rights to corporations. So there is some real question about how it is that we can be so broad and so expansive at the same time. But this is really classic Scalia. I mean, I think that it's not just interesting insofar as he has a very, very cramped notion of who is protected and a very, very, I think, ambitious notion of how easy it would be to pass something like the Equal Rights Amendment, which, as you know, we couldn't pass. So I think he's both, you know, very sort of narrow in his constitutional construction and very, very aspirational in his idea of how we modify the Constitution in this country. But I think this is just of a piece with how Scalia talks. He likes to be bombastic. He likes to be sort of the bad boy. He likes to draw this kind of attention to himself. And I think he is loving the publicity he's getting right now. So this is, you know, he's a very, very funny character. He's been talking like this for decades. I'm going to frankly miss him when he retires someday because there's no one on the court who sort of walks the walk and talks the talk as much as he does. But certainly I think if, you know, your underlying question is, do we have a court that is just freakishly inclined to invent new rights to protect corporate interests at the same time that they are systematically making it harder and harder for ordinary Americans to vindicate their rights in the court, there's no question, and it's very, very, very worrisome.
Well, as you know, Dahlia Lithwick, Justice Stevens had some vigorous dissent over Citizens United, and he was recently on 60 Minutes. Apparently there's more of that interview to come, but what struck me most about Justice Stevens reflecting on his years on the court and what bothered him about the changes on the court, and you know he also has revealed what he thinks happened about capital punishment, where they didn't expect it to go as far as it has gone. But I was struck by what he said about what happened over Bush v. Gore and getting to this idea of the separation of powers in this country and whether or not you have four, you know, right-wing conservatives on the court who may well, you know, basically, I don't know whether in collusion with the Republican Party, but they certainly seem to act on behalf of the Republican Party. Stevens was completely blindsided that they even took that case up because it was such obviously a states' rights case, and there was no he didn't even think that it would get past first base. But then he found out that the Scalia and company not only were going to take it, but they already had their minds made up.
I think that one of the most important things that Justice Stevens has said in the last couple of years, and it's the thing that we forget or we don't remember to listen to, is that with the possible exception of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, every single person on the court in the last 30 years who has retired has been replaced by someone not just to their right, but quite dramatically to their right. And that what it was once, you know, the sort of moderate center of the court is now the left, And what was once the far right of the court is now the center, and there is this new dramatically far right to the court that was unanticipated when he joined the court. In other words, the center of gravity has shifted so dramatically on the Supreme Court that, you know, it is unrecognizable to him as the court that he joined. And, you know, he has said as much in dissent over the years. But I think that for Stevens, you know, when he's asked, you know, how did you move to the left over your career, his answer has consistently been, I've moved nowhere. The court has absolutely moved around me. And I think that Bush v. Gore is an example, as you said, his views of what's happened in the death penalty cases. You know, I think he really has been shocked to see how changes in the composition of the court and a real rightward tilt in appointments and confirmations in the court have affected constitutional law. It's been, I think, very, very dispiriting for him to see something, an institution that he thought was one thing, become something he almost doesn't recognize.
Well, again, Dahlia Lithwick, I'm trying to sort of to find the line here between right-wing ideology and political partisanship, because the effects of Citizens United have been dramatic. We've seen an extremely right-wing group of representatives get elected to the House and the Congress, to the House and the Senate, and we've seen enormous amounts of money spent by front groups who have protected the sources of this money and disguised the sources of this money. And this can only continue in the future. There's no symmetry between the money that labor unions have and the money that corporations have. So I don't know where the legal justification for this ruling is, but I sure as hell know what the political outcome has been.
Well, and you know, one of the real cornerstones to Citizens United, I mean, the key to understanding Justice Kennedy's, you know, decisive fifth vote is that Justice Kennedy said, you know, this won't work unless we have disclosure, unless we have full and open disclosure. And now you're seeing, since Citizens United, a concerted effort to prevent disclosure. So I think one of the things that's really interesting, it both highlights, I think, how naive Justice Kennedy was about believing that disclosure was going to continue to keep the system honest, but also that, you know, on the heels of that triumphant victory, the next move was, and now, you know, if the rules are unconstitutional, we're going to make sure that the disclosure rules are also unconstitutional. So I think you're quite right that, you know, the trend is always to sort of pick up a victory and run harder to the right and make it even more in the interest of big corporations to make sure that their, you know, voices being heard at the court. Citizens United is a really good example of how a sea change happened immediately in the wake of that decision. And America sort of looked around and said, you know, we hated that decision, and yet still we can't pass rules that would provide for, you know, real disclosure.
But, Dahlia, they start very narrow with, like they did with the D.C. gun law, and then blew that out into a radical reinterpretation of the Second Amendment. In this case, the documentary, Hillary the Movie, incidentally, was made by a guy who was the chief investigator for Dan Burton when he held a kind of witch hunt committee looking into Clinton and whether or not Clinton killed his best friend, Vince Foster. And they had this poor, hapless attorney general in jail, Webb Hubble. And this guy re-edited the prison tape interviews and conversations of Webb Hubble to incriminate him. He was fired by Dan Burton, believe it or not, for what he did. And he ends up making this movie that ends up being the basis of this monumental shift in how American elections take place and who finances them and whether these people are accountable and identifiable. So, again, I see a thread in political partisanship here that is really disturbing. I mean, just partisanship, zealous political partisanship.
And in this particular case, the court could have resolved it a year earlier on this very, very narrow question of these pay-per-view movies. In other words, you know, this was a very narrow question that could have been confined to Hillary the Movie. And the idea that this minimalist, humble, you know, simple umpire, balls and strikes court reached out and said, you know what? while this is in front of us, why don't we just revisit all of our precedent in all of our campaign finance law, was, I think, one of the most aggressive and sort of overreaching acts I've ever seen in the court. So I think you're quite right. You know, this was an example of the court that purports to be, you know, only limiting itself to the narrowest thing it can decide, reaching way beyond the confines of this case to, you know, more or less eviscerate decades of campaign finance law. So I think it really, you know, it puts the lie to that word activist. You know, we have this idea that courts are only activist when they reach liberal results. This was one of the most activist acts I have ever seen committed, you know, including possibly Bush v. Gore, in that the court went way beyond what it needed to do, way beyond its mandate, and decided something that wasn't even properly before it.
But you suggested earlier that there are some people on the court, Scalia and the cadre of ultra-conservatives, who had their eye on the ball, and somehow they got this fifth vote from Kennedy, who was a little naive and didn't realize the full scope of it. So I guess we'll leave it at that, but I'm always troubled by constitutional nostalgia just as much as this nostalgia that Glenn Beck and others evoke for a simpler America. What that's a code for is the white Aussie inherited America when blacks and Hispanics were invisible, and we know that the Constitution was basically written for white men only. Do you think there's a thread of this kind of nostalgia that's in a lot of these rulings, or am I being a little unfair here?
Well, I don't know how much of that is in the rulings. I know certainly, you know, there's a lot of anger on the part of some of the more conservative justices about what they feel is an America that, you know, is so devoted to affirmative action that a white man can't get a fair shake. Chief Justice John Roberts famously wrote in an opinion about voluntary desegregation in school programs in Seattle that the only way to get beyond race is to get beyond race, and likened, you know, voluntary busing to try to integrate schools to the kind of discrimination that we saw in the Jim Crow South. So I think the idea that you could even analogize, you know, attempts to make schools that are segregated because of residential housing patterns, that you're trying to make those a little bit more racially mixed, is somehow analogous to Jim Crow segregation in the schools, I think shows that there is this filament of, wow, you know, we have really, really been worked over as white guys, and, you know, it's gone way too far. But I will say, I think, in addition, that some of this Tea Party fondness for the Constitution and for restoring states' rights, and now this new amazing repeal amendment that is gaining momentum that would allow two-thirds of the states to veto acts of Congress, this sort of nostalgia for the idea that states are disenfranchised and that states have, you know, states are people too and they have all sorts of rights, really is reminiscent of some of, you know, the real ugliness we saw in the civil rights era. I was on another radio show yesterday, and a caller called in and said, you know, states' rights people, the 60s are calling, and they say, stop it. You know, I think there is this feeling that the last time we heard this kind of bombastic screaming about how states need to have their rights restored, it was to effect really, really ugly purposes in this country.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Dahlia Lithwick.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who is a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor at Slate, where she specializes in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues. Let's take a brief station break, and then we'll be back talking about whether the regime inside of Iran is becoming unhinged.